It is a great pleasure to have Venerable Thupten Jinpa with us. This is part of a series with the name Religious Pluralism and Civil Society in America. And we've had many people who have come over the course of this semester, in fact, this year. This is really the second year of this set of noontime luncheons, to talk about, from the perspective of their various religious communities, what their work is. Unlike scholars who are studying only Buddhism in America, or Islam in America, or the Hindu tradition in America, or Christianity and Judaism in America, Pluralism Project is concerned more broadly with what it is that takes place in the civic and public life of our country when we begin to recognize more and more, as we are, that we are a multi-religious nation with many strands of belief and practice and many kinds of contribution to the American project, so to speak. And so it's a great pleasure to have someone who born in America, grew up in America, became a Buddhist bhikshuni, a Buddhist nun, and has now turned her thought and energy to the creation, not simply of the Dharma Center in America, of which there are many, 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 but of a monastery and abbey in America for the training of monastics, and an abbey that has not only a vision for itself, but that has outreach into the community with programs of service. So we're really wonderful to have you here, and to make this visit one that is amplified into the Buddhist community of Harvard and the prison community in this area. And we're just delighted that you've accepted our invitation to come. Thank you.
If you were to
talk for half an hour or something like that, okay. However long you would like, half an hour, 35 minutes, uh-huh. Or shorter if you'd like, and then there certainly will be a multitude of questions and engagement with you. So.
Okay. So just to kind of put everything in perspective, I think most of you know that Buddhism began over 26 centuries ago in ancient India with the Enlightenment. Actually, the Buddhism didn't begin then. I don't think the Buddha had the intention of starting a world religion. I don't think he had the intention of starting a world religion, but one began anyway. It spread throughout Asia and into Tibet in the 6th century. There's many different Buddhist traditions worldwide, and they're all coming to America. There's many unique things about the Tibetan tradition in terms of its practices and so on. But one, if you're looking at it from a sociological point of view and coming here, is that Chinese Buddhism, Japanese, Laotian, all the other forms of Buddhism, those people all still have their own country. The Tibetans have lost their country. And so when I studied in India and Nepal, I was studying in a refugee community with people who didn't have their own countries, who were trying to keep it together and raise money to reestablish their own monasteries. So it's very different as a Westerner sitting in a refugee tradition than it is as a Westerner going into, let's say, Thai Buddhism or Chinese Buddhism, where there's still a country. So I studied for many years in India and Nepal, and then as my teachers began to establish Buddhist centers internationally at the invitation of Westerners, they began to send some of the older students out to live in these centers, which was quite a venture. As Nick knows, he was also one of the people doing that. And I ordained in 1977. I was part of the first generation of Westerners to ordain in the Tibetan tradition. So we had no role model in our own culture. Okay, we had the role model of the Tibetan monks, which being a woman, there were some things, in terms of the ethical discipline that we could follow having the role model of the monks, but being women, we couldn't follow everything. There were the Tibetan nuns, but in those days, and still to some extent now, the Tibetan nuns were very shy. I mean, it's just recent years that they've been given the opportunity to have the same education as the monks. And the nuns are very much socialized to just be have no self-confidence and so on. And then you get somebody like me trying to act like that. Imagine what a disaster it is. You know, I mean, I tried so hard to copy the image of the Tibetan nuns, and at one point I said, I can't do this. You know, I'm a Westerner. And I have an education. I had a career. I can't do this. So, you know, it makes it interesting because we're part of a tradition, but we're not part of the tradition. Okay, we follow Tibetan Buddhism, but we aren't part of the Tibetan religious institution. Now, even though many people see me as a representative of it, the Tibetans don't see me that way. Okay, and at first, I felt kind of badly because, you know, this is my tradition. I want to be a member of it, so to speak. And now I see it as a source of freedom because just the establishment of the Abbey, for example, I would not be able to do if I were completely enmeshed in the Tibetan religious institution. For example, in Tibetan Buddhism, all of Buddhism, there's different levels of ordination for women. The full ordination, the transmission of that, never went to Tibet. So I became a novice nun in the Tibetan tradition, but I had to go to Taiwan to take my full vows. Okay. The Tibetan nuns, when they asked permission from the Department of Religious and Cultural Affairs in the exile community, are told no, they don't need to go to Taiwan and take those vows because they already have a complete practice, blah, blah, blah. Well, not having the full ordination impacts your practice, and it impacts your ability to work in society. It impacts your self-confidence. As a Western woman, I was free to go to Taiwan and take the ordination. And I'm free, you know, there's enough of us now who have the seniority where we can actually give the ordination. It's very difficult for the Tibetan nuns to do that because of the social pressure of being in the Tibetan community itself. So, for example, in the Tibetan community, for a nun to strike out on her own and start a monastery, no, you know, the nunneries all have a male abbot, and yeah, they're supervised, so to speak, like that. Even amongst the Westerners, you know, that the way organizations are structured, many people focus very strongly upon their teacher, and they will only start a new project if their teacher tells them to. Okay, I'm a little bit, I guess, different in that respect. I mean, I had this strong feeling that I wanted to establish a monastery, and I realized in the early 90s at a meeting with His Holiness the Dalai Lama and some Western Buddhist teachers, that to wait for the Tibetans to establish a monastery for us Westerners, we would be waiting a long time. You know, some teachers have established some monasteries and nunneries, and they're functioning and doing well, but they're not the priorities of those teachers. It's the lay communities that are the priorities, and so many Dharma centers. So the monks and nuns are there, but they're not the chief emphasis. And I felt strongly that it's important really to preserve the monastic tradition because historically it's been the monastics who have been responsible for learning the teachings, practicing them, passing them on. And part of that comes simply because of the time element. Because when you have a family and a career and a mortgage and car payments and insurance, and you got to pick up the kids and drive them here and plan for their college education, you don't have a lot of time to sit and meditate. When you're monastic and you don't have all those other things going on in your life, you have the time to really study and practice. So it's, I think the time element is a chief differential there. And then also the ethical discipline, you know, as monastics, for example, as a fully ordained nun, I have 348 vows. So in Catholics, it's, you know, simple, three or four. I'm joking, it's not simple, but, you know, so there's a lot of things to pay attention to in our life, and that strictness of the ethical discipline forms a structure around your life that if you are a lay Buddhist, you know, who can practice very well, you have a little bit of a more, what would you call it, anonymous,
anonymity.
Say that word. Okay, but you have more of it. Okay, and people aren't going to notice you. I walk down the street and people notice me. If I mess off, people notice, oh, there's a Buddhist nun who really blew it. Okay, if you're a lay person and, you know, you blow up in lay rage, or road rage, nobody is going to say, oh, you know, the Buddhist is getting angry. Okay? So you know, you have to it acts as a good reminder to be careful about our behavior when we're monastics. But so I felt very strongly, you know, about preserving the monastic tradition, especially in America, you know, where things were so equality based that in some way everything can kind of blend and become one when it's not really one. Where it blends and it goes to the lowest common denominator. How to say this? You know, as Buddhism comes to America and it's, you know, really reaching out to regular people in society, then it's going to adapt itself to the kind of practice that people with busy American lives do. Okay? Whereas if you're a monastic, you practice and train in a very different way. Yeah? As, you know, for in the Dharma centers, you have to have weekend teachings, and they have to be a short amount of time because people have to go home and be with their family. And you can't have a long series of teachings every day because people can't come to the Dharma center every day. And even if they couldn't study the teachings at their home because they're too busy with their work and so on. So, I think that the preservation of the monastic tradition is very important, and yet it's not something that's being emphasized in this country. And unfortunately, in some ways, it's even being disparaged. I know some very well-respected and learned Western Buddhist teachers who have said the monastic life is irrelevant now in 20th century America, which I feel is really sad, because I think that, you know, ordained life is not for everybody, but I think that there should be an option for the people who are attracted to it to be able to live this kind of life. Yeah. So I kind of went on my own, so to speak. I, you know, told His Holiness the Dalai Lama what I wanted to do. He gave his blessings and his permission, and then I was on my own. There's no big Buddhist institution or Buddhist church which funds us or supports us, you know, and not being a member of the Tibetan religious establishment, I'm not as bound by some of their traditions, because if I were, for example, the Abbey, everything's going to be gender equal, or I hope gender irrelevant. That's what I really want. Okay, if I were a member of the Tibetan religious establishment, that would be very difficult because it's not in their culture and the teachers wouldn't expect that. And you kind of have to do things their way. So, you know, this thing of not being part of the institution, which was sorrowful for me at the beginning, now actually gives open space to do things in a different way. In the same way, like, there's different kinds of monasteries. And in the Tibetan tradition that I'm part of, education is really emphasized. And the monasteries are basically schools. You enter when you're a young child, and you memorize, and you debate, and you go through your schooling. And there's not so much specific monastic training in it. It's much more of a school. Okay? As a Western nun, I've been able to train in the Tibetan tradition, but also in the Chinese tradition, because that's where I got my higher ordination. And there they have a different kind of training for monastics. So in establishing the abbey, I want to combine them. I want it to be a place where people can learn, but also where there's very definite monastic training. Okay? And things that I see in the Tibetan tradition that, for me, have become a little bit lax, I want to make a little bit stricter as we're starting out in the West, because I think it's something that benefits people's practice. So my point is here that there's the space to try these kinds of things. Okay. So in terms of the history of the Abbey, I wanted to do this probably for 20 years, but lacked the confidence and lacked the support. And then a few years ago, I met a Theravada monk. And so he also wanted to establish something. We had a very similar vision. So we started to work together to establish something. And after some time, I think he figured out that what he really wanted to do was establish a Theravada monastery in the tradition of his teachers. So we decided to work separately. We're still friends. But what happened is it gave me the working with him got me out of the situation I was living in, being a resident teacher at a Dharma center, into a situation where I could actually start a monastery. And so one of my students in Boise said, well, come here and we'll help you look for land. So I went there just a year ago. Okay, 1 year ago I moved to Boise. We started looking for land in southern Idaho and central Idaho. We made offers on two places, both of them fell through. And so I thought, well, let's start looking in northern Idaho. So I got online, I was looking at the MSL listings for northern Idaho. There was one place in eastern Washington, and they had a picture, and the house had so many windows. And I am a person who loves light. And I looked at this house, and I said, and then I looked at the price, and I said, wow. Because it was about $200,000 more than we were, you know, looking to spend. But the other nun whose house I was staying at when I saw it, she said, go look at it anyway, you know. So I went to look at it anyway. And it was really very sweet. I was with a friend of mine, and, you know, we looked all around, and you know how the realtors don't want you to be too close, the buyers and the sellers to talk. So, but at the end, you know, our realtor was leaving. We went up on the hill just to look one more time. And then we walked down to the barn, and the owner was down at the barn. And we started talking to the owner. And my friend didn't know that you're not supposed to reveal any of your financial information. You know? He didn't know that. So he was saying, well, we only have $300,000. We don't know how we're going to get the rest. And the owner, he didn't know that you're not supposed to reveal any of that kind of stuff to the buyer. And he said, well, that's okay, we'll carry the paper. So that was like this big bonus for us. So finally we negotiated the price, but we, you know, they were able to carry the mortgage for us. Yeah, which was great fortune, really, because I don't think we could have gotten a bank loan, because banks don't like to loan to religious institutions, because if they ever have to, foreclose, then it's very bad publicity. So, so we bought the property, we closed September 30th, and then I moved up there 2 weeks later, and I had to go to Asia for 2 months, got a pre-planned trip, but, you know, we're getting started. So we have one house now. There's another nun who's staying there with me for 4 months on a break from her study program in Australia. And I'm seeing the Abbey as a place mostly to train new people. You know, some people, there's monastics who have been ordained for quite a while. Most of them are busy with their own projects and own work. And also when they've been trained under different teachers, sometimes they do things different ways. So I think sometimes it's easier just to start from the beginning with people who are fresh. Some of the things I'm going to do that's different than how the Tibetans do it is that people are going to get screened and prepared very well before they actually ordain. the Tibetans have this feeling of the more the merrier, so they will ordain almost anybody immediately. And that's part of their culture and their philosophy. In the West, I think it has to work a little bit differently. So there's going to be a lot of screening and preparation. Also, the fact of having men and women together in one monastery, living separately, but doing their education and their practice together. That's a new thing. And also, in the whole way the community functions, I want to have a lot of community meetings where people really talk about their practice. Sometimes we get in this thing where we study together and we'll talk about the teachings, but we don't always talk about what we're wrestling with inside and what's hard for us as we're working with our own minds. And I want to set up a community where people feel comfortable and free to talk about what they're wrestling with. Because spiritual practice isn't just learning a lot of stuff. It's about transforming your mind. When you transform your mind, it is hard work. You need to be able to open up to other people and give support and receive support. So I want to create that kind of community feeling within the people who live there. And then, of course, another unique attribute, I could say, is the emphasis on social engagement. Not to the exclusion of study and practice, because I don't think you can neglect your study and practice. If you do, then your social engagement is going to be tainted by wrong motivation, because our mind very quickly loses its compassion and falls into partiality and blame and anger and so on. And I think to really be socially engaged, you have to have a very, very strong spiritual practice behind that. So to make some kind of balance in there, okay? Do you want me to elaborate more on that thing about why I think the spiritual practice is important? Because, okay, if you take the thing of logging, yeah, for example, in the Northwest, it's an issue. It's very easy to get quite partisan and hate the loggers, okay? Well, the loggers are human beings, and they're trying to earn a living, and they're caught up in a system, and I don't think, as much as I am against clear-cutting and, you know, destroying the environment, and I want to work to stop that, I don't want to work to stop that by hating loggers, okay? Because then you fall through this whole thing of partiality. You take one side and hate the other side, and then basically your mind has become exactly like the people that you're protesting against, okay? Or if we're involved in peace movements, yeah, to speak to blame government officials or to blame terrorist organizations and hate people, then your mind, if we're doing our peace movement by hating the people who are terrorists or hating the people in our government who are pro-war, then our minds become exactly like them in terms of my side's right, the other side's wrong, they're to blame, suffering is caused by outside. You know, let's get everybody on my side. Who cares what happens to the side that we don't agree with? And so I think if you approach social activism in that way, your mind hasn't really changed. It's just your cause. And so that's why I feel that having a very solid spiritual practice is so essential, because it has to be founded on respect for everybody. You know, in Buddhism, we would say their Buddha nature, you know, respect for everybody's potential to become a fully enlightened being, and compassion for everybody. So we people might have very different political opinions from us, but that doesn't mean that we have to hate them, okay? And get on our soapbox and we're right and they're wrong and we do them down. But to have compassion, and compassion doesn't mean pity, okay? It's not like, those poor terrorists, or, oh, poor Donald Rumsfeld, you know, I'm so sorry for him. You know, it's not like that, okay? It's, you know, realizing that people are products of their own conditioning and in many ways do not have freedom, you know? We don't control our conditioning when we're kids. We often don't reflect on our conditioning as adults, and so we just go along with what we've been conditioned as. And so, you know, when we begin in our own lives to see the force of conditioning, conditioning and how it narrows our own mind, then it becomes possible to have compassion for other people who were in the same situation, who were conditioned in a different way. Okay, and so to approach the whole thing of working with different populations with respect and compassion, that social change doesn't need to be motivated and predicated on hatred and on waving the banner of injustice, you know, with anger. Okay, it's a very different Buddhist take, I think, here. Not Buddhist, but, you know, other religions can have it too. But it's different times, you see. In terms of the kind of social engaging things, I kind of, you know, it's funny, I never really had the intention. I didn't sit down and say, okay, I'm going to become socially engaged. It's just, I have the kind of personality, I like to meet people, and I like to hear ideas that are different than mine. And so interreligious dialogue just kind of came natural, because here's people who are different than me. What do they believe? What do they think? You know, how do their minds work? And so I found that quite interesting. So the interreligious dialogue I'm engaged in is mostly with Catholics and Jews, not so much with Protestants. Now, and I think there's a little bit of a question mark there, like why and what's going on. I've done some work with Muslims, but not a whole lot with Protestants. Very interesting. Maybe that's a topic for research investigation or something. And then some hospice work. You know, again, I don't go out and say, okay, here I am a hospice volunteer, but being quote clergy, you could say, you know, people often when they're suffering or whatever, then they will call and I go. Yeah. So I think that opportunity to be involved with people who are dying is very precious. There's a kind of honesty there when you're dealing with the dying that very often we don't have in our human relationships. And I like that correctness a lot. And I've gotten involved in prison work. Again, it's a funny story because the first inmate that, I got involved in prison work because somebody, I got a letter, okay, and started writing to this guy, and then one thing led to another. Well, this particular inmate, when I asked him, I said, how did you get my address? And he said, well, I was writing to a bunch of different Buddhist groups. And then he said, but I went back and I looked over the list of people I wrote to and you weren't on it. And your organization wasn't on it. And so he sent it to a bunch of different organizations. I have no idea how I got his letter. Yeah. But that was the start of it, because I responded to his letter and got involved, and then he had a friend in another prison who wrote to me, and then had a friend, and then I started. Then people who weren't related to him, didn't know him, I just started getting letters. I have no idea how people got my address, you know, but I started getting letters. So I respond. You know, this is, I don't have a choice. We practice what's called the Bodhisattva path, where you're really training your mind in cherishing everybody. And so when people come to you for help, you don't have a choice of whether to respond or not. You respond, okay, to the best of your capability. And I found the prison work incredible. You know, I never would have thought that I would have done it, you know, because I always kind of feel a little bit vulnerable, and I'm not very big, and I'm not very strong, and it's like, you know. But I can walk into a prison, I feel totally safe in a prison, you know, and it's not because the guards are there. Believe me, I'm as afraid of them as I am of everybody else. But I find it tremendously rewarding in many different ways. First of all, the inmates are so appreciative of help. Yeah, they appreciate it. When I go to various Buddhist centers, you know, people come, but if there's something good on TV that night, they'll skip it. Okay, you know, people have busy lives. It's not their priority, you know, so they don't always make it to events. Inmates, when you come there, they are there and they track every single word that you say. and they take it to heart. They think about it the entire year until you come back next. It's amazing. You know? They really, you know, the ones who are at the point where they're interested in this kind of spiritual transformation, that they're incredible people. They really take the teaching seriously. A way that they've affected me is that many of the people that I work with have done the crimes that I am most afraid of. Okay? So, you know, it's very good because what it's done, I see them as human beings. I don't see them as a rapist. I don't see them as a pedophile. I don't see them as a murderer. You know, they are a human being who is asking me for help and for guidance and to act as a mirror or, you know, somebody that helps them along the path. And in that process of that dialogue that I have with them, I mean, it's so personal that there's no way to put them in a category. And so what it's done for me personally is to really help me see that we can't just give people a label and think we know everything about them and sign them off. Yeah, we can't say Osama bin Laden is a terrorist, put him in the closet, throw him out the window. This guy's a murderer, put him in the closet, throw him out a window. You know, people's lives are much more complicated. People are not simply one event in their life, okay? And they aren't simply, you know, the theology or political philosophy that they live their life by. People are very complex. And to learn to really respect everybody in that way, it's been a tremendous gift to me. I mean, I always feel that they teach me much more than I teach them. And listening to the stories of their childhood, you cannot believe what people have gone through in their lives. And when I think of children in this country going through what these inmates went through, and there's still children going through it, it's like our society has programmed these kids to wind up in prison as adults because we're not giving them what they need as children. You know, in terms of education, in terms of safety, in terms of society caring about them. And so I think there's so much to be learned from inmates and their life experience about what we as a society can do to prevent people from getting into crime. But our society basically tunes the inmates out. I mean, that's one population. It's very easy, you know, to disenfranchise them. They can't vote. They're mostly poor. They're locked up. Ignore them. They don't have anything to teach us. They're criminals. They have a lot to teach us, I tell you, and a lot of experience, and I think we need to hear it. Yeah. My personal, my little soapbox here. okay, I think that's important. Another little socially engaged thing that I'm just getting into now is moving into rural Washington. Okay, near northern Idaho, near Hayden Lake, if any of you have heard of Hayden Lake, which is where they had the, you remember the big, the court case? What was it, the Aryan Nation? You know, where they had killed somebody and then they got sued and their organization dissolved, and now he's running for city council again. But, you know, I mean, it is, that area is the heart of white supremacist America, which is not the environment I grew up in. But it's quite interesting for me to live there, and, you know, slowly I really want to make friends with the people in the community. Sunday we had an open house for some of our neighbors and people we've done business with in town, and just to get to know them and how they think and how they view the world. And I'm realizing in the process of doing this how much our country has become centered on urban centers and how much rural people have been left out of America in many ways. What's going on there, how they think, what's important to them. But I'm just starting to get a feel for that, so in a year I might have something more to say. Okay. But I really want to establish good relationships with the people in the town. Words got out that there's some Buddhists there. Okay, they're not quite sure what Buddhists are. And there's so much misinformation, especially about Tibetan Buddhism. You know, everybody thinks you have sex and drink. And then, of course, we were rich, so then they think you're like Bhagavan Rajneesh, you know, the group in Oregon who collected the arms. So somehow we want to give a different public image. So my philosophy, it was interesting, the guy who came to work on the septic system last week, you know, he would say, well, what do you guys do? And I said, well, we pray and we meditate and we mind our own business and we're good neighbors. And he said, oh, mind your own business. That's the kind of people I like. This is libertarian country, you know. They are anti-government. Mm-hmm. Yeah? Everybody, you know, your own business. Nobody's going to manage me and tell me what to do. So I realized, okay, I've got to remember to say that a lot. My own business. Okay. So I'm thinking in town of doing like a little stress reduction workshop at the public library, just as a way to make contact with the local people. I was trying to think before I left how we would do my bio, because my bio is mostly Buddhist stuff, but I don't want to present it to the community as, you know, I'm a Buddhist nun, blah, blah, blah. So I'm trying to think of how to write a bio without telling people what you do. Yeah. But somehow to blend into the community, to bring some goodness in there. You know, because what I'm discovering is that, and it's so funny, just the political landscape of the country now, how some of the people on the far right, there's certain issues that I agree with them on, you know, but their general philosophy I don't agree with. You know, I'm much more towards the left. But then there are certain issues on the right that, you know, I find agreement. So if I'm moving into this kind of, you know, political environment in rural America, how to find the things that I agree with people on and build those bridges based on that without creating animosity about the things that we disagree on. And hopefully later on, you know, the things that we disagree can be talked about in a more harmonious way. So that's a little bit of an experiment, too.